Good morning, and folks, get a pen and paper handy because we've got a whole lot of important dates and times for events coming up. Seriously, I'm not sure we're going to get to all of these announcements this morning.
Good morning, and welcome to One Land, Many Voices, your host this morning and every fourth Friday of the month at 9 a.m. are Will Seaman and myself, Hala Goris. Good morning, Will.
Good morning, Hala, and a special thank you and good morning to all of you who called in to become members or renew your membership during the Voices of the Middle East a couple weeks back with Gudarz Ekhtedari. And if you weren't tuned in then, well, take the opportunity today to become a KABU member or renew your membership at the KABU website at www.kabu.fm.
And with us in the studio this morning, our special guest, a local guest, is Rabbi Joey Wolf. Thank you, Rabbi Joey, for joining us this morning on One Land, Many Voices.
It's a pleasure being here with you this morning.
Rabbi Joey Wolf is the rabbi of Havura Shalom, a Jewish fellowship active in Portland since 1978, a congregation that prides itself on broad participation and diversity, as well as responsible social action. Rabbi Joey has been at Havura since 1987. He was a rabbi for a congregation in Austin, Texas, prior to coming to Portland.
Rabbi Joey is also a member of the National Board of Rabbis for Human Rights and serves on the Rabbinic Advisory Committee for Britzidik Shalom, Veshalom, sorry about that. And he also is active in our local community, serving on commissions and boards in the metropolitan Portland area, including most recently with workers' rights panels for Jobs with Justice. He is co-founder of a local dialogue group which probe relationships and affinities between Jewish and Muslim and Arab leaders in the community, and much, much more. Rabbi Joey, it's a pleasure to get this chance for our discussion this morning.
I'm looking forward to it a great deal.
Now, this morning, we return to a topic we've discussed on One Land, Many Voices on a number of occasions, the topic of Zionism. Some time back, we talked with Joel Colville, author of Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. And not too long ago, we continued our discussion with Zachary Lockman, New York University professor of Middle East Studies and History, for a somewhat more historical discussion of Zionism. Today, we return to yet another facet of Zionism in an effort to get at the many ways this idea or doctrine is thought of within and outside of the Jewish community.
We are sorry to say that we can't take calls this morning, but Rabbi Wolf has said that he will be joining us again for a continuation of this discussion. So there will be opportunities for our listeners to ask questions on a future One Land, Many Voices with Rabbi Joey Wolf.
Rabbi Wolf, I think it's fair to say that Zionism today is typically thought of as the doctrine or ideology driving the creation of the State of Israel. But perhaps we can start off this morning with your own experiences and understanding of Zionism. And from there, we can begin to draw connections to the other ways that Zionism is understood.
Well, the whole idea that this is a doctrine or an ideology is probably a bit mistaken in the sense that any ism is an afterthought. It you know, it's a definition of a whole set of events, many streams that led into something that was happening that was rather remarkable. It took decades to happen. It was a combustion of ideas, an explosion of creativity, and that creativity largely came out of Eastern Europe for the most part initially, in the sense that people were very confined in Christian Europe, especially in Poland and what was known as the Pale of Settlement in Russia, where they were very much oppressed and for years and years and years had to figure out, well, what do we do next? How do we think about our plight? You know, how do we teach our kids? How do we raise our kids? How do we renew sparks within ourselves? How do we become imaginative? Every downtrodden group is familiar with this idea that there are always imaginative people who try to figure out a way to renew a sense of hope and to be idealistic about the world. So it largely comes out of that experience. Now, there are many forms of Zionism. That is to say, there are all kinds of people who thought about what it meant to go and live in a new place, what it meant to be poets again, farmers again, what it meant to go and live and create the ideal society, to be socialists, to share things, to share their produce together. All kinds of people in Eastern Europe were thinking about what it meant to move. And this is even prior to thoughts about a state or a government or geopolitics, all of those pieces. And you asked me about my own experience. I could just tell you that, like, I grew up in America, a typical Jew in the middle of the 20th century, in the sense that I was aware of institutional anti-Semitism, and there were these songs in the background, there were these poems, there were people incredibly compassionately idealistic and utopian, frankly. They thought only the nicest thoughts about what could be over there, what kind of a society you could build that would be hopeful and would be a beacon to the world. So I grew up thinking that Zionism was just a further expression and outcome of my own Jewish ideas and my Jewish upbringing. And, you know, I learned it at home as the mother's milk. It was from my grandmother, who was just only looking to do good things and to create something fine and open and connected to others.
Rabbi Joey, to lay ground for what we're talking about here today, what are the different forms of Zionism?
So looking back, and when we say back, we're talking about to the second half of the 19th century. There were people, again, who were writing, who were trying to think about, well, what do we do that's pedagogical to reimagine what it means to train the next generation. What does it mean to think of yourself as Jewishly proud? What do we have to do in order to do that? There were Zionists in Eastern Europe in the tiniest little places where Jews didn't even own land, and yet they were working on becoming farmers. It's kind of funny in retrospect. There were Jews who were highly socialistic. They had it with religious identity. And they wanted to form socialist kinds of networks. And when they were thinking about making a move, finally, very, very, very audaciously to this new world, to get out of their oppressive climate in, say, Poland, they actually had socialist ideas. Many of them did. There were poets, there were naturalists, there were Nietzscheists, Nietzschean kinds of Zionists who really wanted to unite with nature. I mean, it was a free for all. It was almost, in many ways, in that sense, it was almost like a 60s rebellion, in terms of its utopianism. It was wildly idealistic. And in fact, there were many of these folks who went over to Israel and died. And the reason that they died was they weren't ready to do the hard work to, quote, reclaim the land. And often untold or unknown stories, many of them came to dead ends. They came to suicide because they were depressed or disappointed at the naivete of their own endeavors. The naivete is critically important.
Rabbi Joey, the only Palestinian in the studio is sitting here thinking, you said to return to Israel, but you're really talking about them going to Palestine.
So any Jew who prays in the morning or sings the songs that are part of the religious structure, no matter how religious he or she is, okay, I happen to be a religious Jew, or any Jew who celebrates Passover, or any Jew who goes to a wedding, knows at every ceremony there's a reference to what once was. And when people are downtrodden, as you know as a Palestinian, you want to reclaim and recover, reconstitute what once was. I mean, it fuels your visionary sense about what could be today. So, one of the great slogans of that era was, we're going to take a land, people without a land, and we're going to a land without a people. I actually have a book from that era. And, of course, the land without a people, it shows sand dunes, because that was the way of promoting that vision, that it was empty. And the naivete was amazing throughout the early part of the 20th century on the part of Jewish idealists, but in truth also Jews who were escaping their own travesties. But they didn't think very much back then, for the most part, there were exceptions, about, gee, what if there are other people living there?
Now, you've talked a little bit about what I'm going to probably also inaccurately refer to as a kind of a cultural Zionism. And the kind of comparisons that I've come up with in terms of my own trying to understand this movement, and I should say from the beginning that I was brought up completely secular. So my own Jewish identity, we can talk about another time, but it did not involve this idea of an affinity with Israel or the Zionist traditions, myriad and diverse as they are. But this idea of cultural Zionism, a kind of a rebirth, a kind of a Jewish nationalism or a reworking of Jewish identity, didn't always involve the idea or need for a state. And certainly there were fluid trends within Zionism that conceptualized a homeland in a radically different way than a state, for example. And I wonder if you could explore that.
So the writer, the thinker, Ahad Ha'am, that's a pen name, meaning one of the people. His real name was Asher Ginsberg. Okay, he was a guy from Eastern Europe, a great intellect. Kind of what I would like to say, a pristine Zionist. He spoke about this notion of the homeland being a place like the heart that would pump blood to the Jews in the diaspora. He never had the idea that all Jews should go and live there. He was not motivated by issues that were intrinsically political. He was imagining, well, the formation of a university, museums, theaters. His view was that some elite few would go and live there and would pump the blood, the cultural, the proud blood back into the people and sort of revitalize the Jews who lived all over the world. It was not his brand of Zionism that we commonly call today a political Zionism that came out of the West. Largely out of Western Europe and later on from America, that it was his view was that simply you wanted to revitalize the culture. And so he didn't speak to the, as far as I know, to the issues of statehood and the apparatus, the paraphernalia that go along with, you know, a modern state.
So, Rabbi, there had been brands of Zionism, probably it's fair to say prior to the Holocaust, that did not have intrinsic within that ideology that there must be an exclusivist Jewish state.
For sure. But as you come up into the 20s and especially into the 1930s, you know, it was inevitable that Jews going to live in that land without a people would discover that there were people there, and people were extremely defensive and hostile to them, as can be understood in retrospect. If you don't build bridges, and if you're building this little society around you, the neighbors are not going to take very kindly to you coming in and taking up land. And ultimately, very idealistic Zionists sort of became morphed, if you will, into defensive Zionists. You put up a kibbutz, you put up a tower, and the tower had a watchman, and then suddenly you are arming yourself, and that became part of, it's strange in retrospect to think about this, but it became part of the image of the utopian Zionist was someone with a gun in his hand. And we appropriated that imagery. I mean, it became part of the sense that, like, well, we had to defend ourselves. And, you know, in all honesty, there's a story, there's a narrative that we learn and we imbibe, and it becomes part of us, and we look at it quite naively, as I did growing up, that this was the only way we could live because people were very hostile to us and we didn't understand it until you look back much later on and understand that, obviously, there's another civilization there.
But didn't the highest level of Zionist leadership, including virtually all of the founding fathers of the State of Israel, in their political Zionism, embrace the concept of transfer or the expulsion of the indigenous Palestinian Arab population?
Gosh, I hope not. I mean, at one point or another, there were people high up, critically high up, that was part of their discourse within their, we'll call it the kitchen cabinet of their governments, part of the discourse from the standpoint that they were trying to make that nascent community, yeshuv, settled community, be integrated, stand up on its own, and continue and perpetuate itself. In other words, they had a constituency, and this is part of the issue within Zionism, within this whole discussion about, gee, what do we do about Israel and Palestine, is that we all have constituencies. They felt the pressure early on to be responsible to protect the people that they had around them who were dispersed around that little piece of land. It's a little piece of land, but they were dispersed. So how do you protect them? You keep them close to other little settlements, and you unite them, and you unify them, and you militarize them. And occasionally, undoubtedly, part of the military strategy that was emergent was to move away, right, was to clear that area of local, we'll say a local village that was causing trouble, from which, you know, there were shots coming, people displeased with these newcomers.
Or shots not coming. I mean, in some cases, I'm thinking of, in particular, more recent Israeli historians who have, and this to me gets to the role of a Zionist conception of what was going on, partly naive, as you say, but partly, at least as I read the history, a deliberate deception, not just of Palestinians, but of Jews moving there, being misled and deliberately misled,
right,
about what they were coming into. And I recall in particular, it was either an Australian or a Canadian Jewish commander who was ordered to clear a village that had clearly not made that was not a threat, and his resistance to that, and that speaks to, I think, again, these many divisions within Zionism, that you had people who, I think, and I think Ben Gurion among them,
sure,
who were quite deliberate about saying, we need a Jewish-only state. We cannot survive if we have this mixed population.
Well, so there's a leap from the 20s and 30s, you know, up into the 40s. And, of course, you have the, you know, without, obviously, you've got the awful event of the Shoah, of the Holocaust, intruding, and the politics around the Holocaust, and the world's need to be accountable or answerable, all of those issues in the meantime. But what I was going to say, Will, is that, you know, that's what politicians do. Politicians deceive. They find ways to help their constituencies, and later on we read the books, we read the stories, the revisionist histories, which point out what's really going on during a given period. I guarantee you today things are going on that are deceptive. We all know that. People are being pushed aside, denied certain rights, denied certain possibilities, and that was going on then. Absolutely, without a doubt. Was that Zionist? No, it's not called Zionist. Because I don't recognize that as intrinsically Zionist. I don't like it. That's what politicians were doing, and I don't like that story. And now there's a transparency, and we have to come to terms with it. Zionists like myself have to come to terms with it. Okay, and those who didn't, within my camp of Zionists, or Jews who love Israel, you know, or Jews who are lukewarm on Israel, we all need to come to terms with the fact that this kind of stuff went on, and we shouldn't be surprised. But now we have to figure out, so how do we own it, and how do we talk about it, and how do we make political arrangements today that are honorable and inclusive of the actual people who live in that land, and how do we honor the other narrative besides our own that is fully evolved?
So it sounds like what you're saying is that you, as a Zionist, you yourself, not speaking for all Zionists out there, feel like you have to come to terms with what happened to the indigenous Palestinian Arab population.
Right.
And so in your view, what did happen?
My view, I think it's pretty clear that there were people who were pushed into refugee status. I think the numbers, and I'm crummy at numbers, I'd say 700 to 800,000 at least, at least the conservative view of revisionist historians, were pushed into refugee status in the Nakba during the period of 1947 to 1949. I remember in the early 1970s living in Israel, and I remember taking walks over the hills, a naive Zionist at that point, and walking into, Arab villages to drink tea with people I already knew, because I would go back several times, and walking on the way to those villages, I would walk through little fields and suddenly come upon a crumbling wall or the crumbling side of a house. And that portrait of the landscape stays in my mind, and it's part of the cultural geography there. It's pretty clear what happened, that there was, widespread, in many cases, deliberate, politically and militarily inspired fright tactics to rout numbers of villages. And then there were other villages who picked up and fled for good reason. If you see rowdy going on, it's a mixture of things that happened. But it's our role now to come to terms with that. I would suggest to you that some people want to say that, the whole society is criminal and all of that, and the state is inherently mm-hmm. criminal, and, you peel away at 20, 30, 40, 50 years of society, you can't peel back to the core. But on the other hand, what's at the core is the fact that we all need to talk, and we need to reconcile ourselves to what happened, the travesties that occurred, in order to live in a neighborly way and in a just way.
Mm-hmm. And Rabbi, to also acknowledge the massacres that occurred, because those have been well documented.
Yes, and this is a hard thing. There were massacres. There's no question that there were massacres. What's hard for the Jewish community abroad, as well as in Israel, is the fact that over the subsequent decades, there has been widespread violence as a response to that hardship that occurred during the Nakba. The shedding of blood in ways that scares and angers and enrages and frustrates a whole population, and basically serves to confuse people. And then people go into their little shuttered little homes, and they go into they pigeonhole themselves, and they become entrenched, and their politics becomes a politics of polemics. But absolutely, these massacres went on. Absolutely, people lost lives, people lost connection to land, people's property was confiscated, and it's our job today. As Zionists, I'm speaking for myself and many friends of mine who love Israel on the one hand, and yet we're chagrined by policies that continue to take place. And we feel like this absolutely is an encroachment upon a would-be peace process. There's not going to be any peace process unless both sides recognize where the fallacy of what it is they're doing, but on our end, that we continue to confiscate land, and we do it not just on the West Bank, but we do it in Jerusalem. And this is, there are some of us who call this a pre-state awful policy, and now the pre-state awful policy is lingering many decades later, and that's wrong.
And you're listening to One Land, Many Voices. You're tuned to KABU, listener-sponsored radio, community radio, 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. Naturally, also available as streaming audio at KABU's website at kabu.fm. And our guest this morning on One Land, Many Voices is Rabbi Joey Wolf. And our topic this morning, although we're covering quite a bit of ground, is Zionism. And I'd like to return to that topic. We have discussed this with folks like Joel Koval and Zachary Lockman. And this whole idea that I think is very entrenched within different communities and people who are engaged with this issue, that Zionism as a doctrine, or just as you say, however we want to talk about Zionism, has within it these fundamental tensions with a conception of a truly democratic society, that it has within it fundamentally the seeds of discrimination and chauvinism. And I wonder if you could talk about that element to the ideology, how that is maybe being discussed or interrogated or thought about within Zionists today.
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, so I talk to both people who are active in political camps in the peace process, trying to make a peace process happen. I also talk to Jewish scholars who look at that whole period of history. They look at the issue of historiography, and they look at some of the impulses behind Zionism. Actually, Zionism had to do with a radicalization of history, the freeing of history from itself. In other words, there are many theories that Zionism in some ways arises out of the hotbed of poverty and out of impoverishment and the very things that we're railing against today, injustice. That Zionism was a way of freeing, as it were, the messianic sparks. In other words, it was an idealistic kind of thing. So the people I work with today, largely, so Rabbis for Human Rights, for instance, are people both in Israel and here in North America, are people who still have these impulses that, my God, what we're trying to do is to foster a vision that's about a society that is in some ways what the prophet Isaiah called Or LaGoyim, a light unto the nations. Everybody's familiar with that expression, a beacon. And the notion that we arm ourselves or get down into our trenches and fight it out, go into denial, confiscate land, just arm ourselves preemptively against the next crazy attack from Hamas or Hezbollah, and that's all the name of the game is. That's just incredibly, incredibly flies in the face of what the original impulses were to free history and to make this place a beacon to the nations. So there's a fatigue among people who are idealists, people who love Israel, people who love the possibilities that Israel could become. There's a fatigue about this kind of polemical kind of state of affairs.
So, let me make it more concrete. What I'm trying to explore, if Zionism has within it this idea of a state, or if some part of Zionism has this idea of a Jewish state, and today we see this so concretely. I'll give you the example of the recent discussions, the demand by the Israeli government that Israel not only be recognized, its right to exist. That used to be the demand, that the Palestinian leadership had to recognize Israel's right to exist. Now it's that the Palestinian leadership has to recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And we have what, for me at least, was a rather shocking spectacle of the President of the United States essentially endorsing this view. Now, this seems to be a pretty fundamental part of Zionism, of the Zionist conception of Israel, and yet it is so much at odds with the idea of a nation of its citizens. Over 20% of Israel are non-Jewish citizens.
But is it? I mean, is it really fundamentally at odds? I mean, should Irish people, regret that there is a state called Ireland and that there is a majority there, or they push one particular culture? Or in Sweden, should we say that Swedish should not be the official language? Or in other words, we say that we live in a post-nationalist world, and those of us who would like to imagine a world that's united by let's just say institutions founded in justice might hope that. But the truth of the matter is you have a world of nation states. I suppose what you're asking is, and I think I get it, is how can you have a Jewish state and how can it be democratic at the same time? And clearly,
for its non-Jewish citizens.
Right, I understand. And I think we have a crummy track record. There's no question about it. On the one hand, look, Israel is a democratic society with a free, open discourse, free, open press, with modern democratic institutions, right, existing in the midst of many, many, many Arab countries. You know, I mean, autocratic countries where there, you know, people, except in the case of Lebanon, you know, where they shoot it out to change the succession, and where people are, look, you know about the Arab Human Development Report that lists, you know, all of the curtailments to human dignities in all of the countries surrounding Israel. So Israel's a democratic society. There's no question about that. People, on the one hand, are able to talk about anything, are able to fight anything in the open, with an open discourse. One particular Palestinian right now, who is, you know, very, very outspoken about boycott of Israel, is taking, you know, goes studies at the Hebrew University. And anybody who's been to the Hebrew University knows that's a place for Jews and Arabs to enter into discourse freely. And so it's a democratic society on the one hand. On the other hand, it's also clear, abundantly clear, that we have absolutely not served the Arab villages, the Arab population that lives within the Green Line. We've completely deserved them. There are no equities. There's no justice in terms of money or services. And there's no question that the state has failed in recognizing its duty to enfranchise those citizens. So the track record on that count is poor, and we got a lot of work to do.
Rabbi, let's probe that a little bit further in terms of Israel being a democracy. There are over 20 laws on the book in Israel that discriminate against non-Jewish citizens. Okay? How can a democracy have laws that discriminate against Israeli Palestinian citizens or all non-Jewish citizens of the State of Israel?
Right. How can a democracy have a Guantanamo?
Let me back up.
You know what I'm saying to you is like this is, you're right. You're absolutely right. These are the kinds of things that we absolutely need to fight out and change. They're wrong.
So,
but
if
democracies are hotbeds of injustice too. I mean, nothing's to say that any of these democracies in Israel or in America are perfect in any way. And in fact, this is horrible what you're bringing up. We need to fight to change it. And we have outspoken, do you know how many human rights groups there are in Israel that speak freely and proudly? If you pick up the newspaper, you read, it makes the New York Times pale. I mean, when you read Haaretz, because you read people attacking all of the sacred cows in Israel. I mean,
but Rabbi, isn't it more fair to say that Israel is a democracy for Jews? It is not a democracy for Palestinian citizens of Israel who don't have the right of return that Jews have.
I think you're absolutely right. Currently, I mean, I say our track record is poor. We got a lot of work to do, a lot of injustice. I absolutely agree with you. And that's why, as a member of the Board of Rabbis of Human Rights, you know, we need to rail against these injustices, these exclusions. And you're right. I mean, hey, if this is a country that claims it's a democracy, get with it. Become a democracy. Oh, absolutely.
We're going to take a little music break. If our engineer has got this new music queued up, we're going to go to this, and then we'll be back to continue our discussion of Zionism this morning on One Land, Many Voices.
Está en fortuna, mira que te va a llevar. Que la mar está en fortuna, mira que te va a llevar. Que me ven, que me traiga mano, 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 siete frutas de hondo. Que me gruta peche preto para salvar de la voz. Que me gruta peche preto para salvar del amor.
And we're back with One Land, Many Voices. I'm Will Seaman, and with me in the studio is co-host Hala Gores and Rabbi Joey Wolf of Havor Shalom Congregation here in Portland. And our topic is Zionism. We're not taking calls this morning, but Rabbi Joey's agreed to come back another time, so we'll continue this discussion. It certainly is. There's so many dimensions of this idea, and yet it has become, it is such an emotionally charged idea, the idea of Zionism. So I want to turn to this again to get at and to try to tease apart these identities, in particular the identity of a Zionist. And I think, of course, so many people who touch this issue are familiar with what's going in going on in Hebron or among the more aggressive settlers in the West Bank, where you have people who identify as Zionists, I think very strongly identify as Zionists, and are not shy about saying, this is the land of the Jews. Those people have to get out. They don't belong here. They have so many other countries they can live in. They shouldn't be in our country. And yet, of course, we have Rabbis for Human Rights, many people who identify as Zionist who are appalled by that chauvinism, by the bloody-minded activities of these settlers. How can we think about Zionism? You know, it's interesting because there seems to be a parallel with this discussion of democracy. We want to talk about the democratic institutions of, say, the State of Israel, the fact that there's the Knesset, a parliament, the fact that we have elections, like here in the United States, we have elections. And yet we know these are the formal dimensions of a democracy, but do we really want to call it a true democracy? What are the real elements of a democracy? But in Zionism, how do we tease apart these conflicting notions?
Oh, well, I hate to admit it, but some of my former best friends are and people, members of my family, that is to say, I don't mean members of my immediate family, but certainly part of my family line on one side, are part of that community, the settler community, people who live in the territories, people that whose politics are anathema to my own. I think that many of us here in the States who are Jewish and are connected to Israel know folks or have relatives, perhaps. I've known people who since the middle of the early 1960s have gone to live in Israel, and unfortunately, in my view, they entertained a vision of Zionism that was essentially a deviation from the mainstream. It's sort of like being on a highway, taking the wrong exit, getting off and getting into a subdivision, eventually ending in a cul-de-sac. And these folks developed a view that was predicated on the notion that you live in the land, you take back your history. And they were not only radical about that, many of them, one I'm thinking of right now, but many of them were idealistic but very naive at best. At worst, they've adopted a brand of politics which is, of course, in my view, wholly unjust, not pragmatic, to say the least, and offensive, in that they lived in a vacuum. And the vacuum could be in relationship to the villages next door. Now, the truth is that these folks are also in the minority in Israel, meaning the ones who are extremists, who are ideological. They're in a tiny minority. But the problem is that they've hijacked the political discourse. And we have to keep pointing that out so that the work of many people, not just rabbis for human rights, but I dare say plenty of silent liberal Jews in the middle here in this country, and of course the vast majority of they call themselves secular Jews in Israel, find this whole expression of Zionism to be utterly, utterly obnoxious. But again, they've hijacked the political discourse, and we have to keep speaking out against it.
But without the Israeli military.
Oh, I agree with you. Yeah, the Israeli military has always been implicated And in fact, many sides of a fragmented political establishment, that's what I mean, a dysfunctional coalition politics, has given too much sway to the people who are essentially extremists. And I do believe it. Like, there's no question that the military has way too often gotten in bed with these settlers. Many infractions, many transgressions against Israeli law, never mind international law.
Actually, that's a good segue into an announcement I'd like to make. Tonight on Bill Moyer's Journal, this is the so-called controversial investigation of the Israeli Defense Forces in terms of the assault on Gaza last year. Bill Moyer's talks with the man at the center of this storm, Justice Richard Goldstone, who, despite working with many pro-Israel groups and Israeli institutions in the past, has drawn intense criticism from some of Israel's supporters for his report on the investigation into the to the UN Human Rights Council. Goldstone is a renowned war crimes investigator who's looked into human rights abuses in his native South Africa, as well as former Yugoslavia, Argentina, and Rwanda. Rabbi Joe, you spoke with Richard Goldstone recently. Can you talk a little bit about his connection with Zionism, with the State of Israel, and with this very clear criticism of Israeli policies?
Yes, he's a wonderful man. He's being tarred by many mainstream Jews, very unfortunately. He has an impeccable record. He went on, more correctly speaking, a fact-finding mission. So he's very clear in saying that the information that he raises to the surface and brings to light requires that independent investigations be, undertaken. And what's so unfortunate is that a society that claims to be a democracy, which Israel is, I believe, is stonewalling this report at a time when it would be absolutely to Israel's benefit to portray itself as open and transparent and capable of self-criticism, the way it did after the horrors of Sabra and Shatila with the Khan Commission. They're capable. That society is capable of doing an investigation. What's happening is that mainstream American Jews are making the political calculation, and I believe a wrong one, of saying that it's best that you don't take a report like this to a body such as the United Nations Human Rights Council, because that body has unfortunately a pretty bad track record of politicizing these kinds of things, and the American Jewish community is making the calculation that there is an equation implied in this report that it's a one-sided assault on human rights from the side of Israel vis-a-vis people who lived in Gaza, and that nothing's being said about the attacks, the awful attacks from Hamas that went on year after year, targeted deliberately at innocent citizens. So, on the other hand, Richard Goldstone has clearly reported on both, and it's our job to look at ourselves, to put ourselves in the spotlight, and to do the investigation that a democratic society should do.
This is a good time for us to also let folks know about the Rachel Corrie play, which will be in Corvallis through Sunday. My Name is Rachel Corrie's at the Oregon State University in Corvallis from October 21 through the 25th. If I could point out, each evening they will have different speakers there. But Saturday, October 24th, Joel Bainan, history professor at Stanford University, will be there talking about the historical context of My Name is Rachel Corrie. And then my very good friend Lee Gordon of Hand in Hand will be the fourth Friday speaker at Congregation Shir Tikvah, Friday, October 23rd, as part of their Erev Shabbat service.
And that's tonight. And
that is tonight.
And I'd like to put in a plug for Lee Gordon because, he's part of a number of people who eschew the macro picture in order to do the pragmatic work on the ground and build bridges between Jews and Palestinians. And, He does some great work in founding schools for Jews and Arabs to learn together and for parents to discover each other and to discover the humanity on both sides. And that's such an impressive kind of bit of work that Lee has done in founding those schools called Hand in Hand.
And we're going to leave all of these announcements out at the front desk here at KBOO. So if you've missed something, you can give us a call, and we should have those details at the front desk. I also want to mention that there is a dinner and critically acclaimed play. This is a benefit hosted by Students United for Palestinian and Equal Rights, SUPER, over at Portland State University. It's a dinner, an Arabic dinner. And there will be a performance of the play Seven Jewish Children. And donations will help students participate in a mile-long march to break the siege on Gaza. And that's Friday, November 6th. So you have a little bit of time to plan for that at 6 p.m. at the PSU Smith Building Ballroom. Again, that's November 6th on the PSU campus. But we are going to now continue our discussion. And I do want to mention one question that has come up time and again here on this program, but also in local discussions of this issue, since so many of these discussions occur in churches as well as synagogues. And the question is how Christians in the region are involved. International organizations like World Council for Churches and member churches. How does both, let's say, Christian Zionists, but also organizations, say, like Friends of Sabeel, how do they play into the discussion, the debate, the tension there?
To be honest, I think people of goodwill tend to muddy the atmospherics of political work, and I say this in the sense that there. I'm involved in two kinds of political work, two different dimensions of political work. So I speak as someone who wears a cap for human rights, Rabbis for Human Rights, where we simply speak out against human rights independently of political context. And we feel it's very important to do that. We feel it's important to support the Goldstone findings. And we feel it's very important to support the people who are stuck in Gaza, irrespective of whatever we know that's happened in the south of Israel, irrespective of Hamas's or Hezbollah's shooting, targeting of innocent citizens. We feel it's important to talk about human rights of all people, and we're well aware of what goes on in Gaza. So there's the human rights dimension, and then there's the political dimension. And those of us who work in the politics in the Middle East and try to get from step A to step B to step C to step D, we're pragmatically informed. We try to come up with positions that will be saleable to constituencies when other constituencies around the world get involved in the act. Sometimes things get very, very, very muddy, and I really hesitate to speak for Christians on the left or Christians on the right, except to say that I'm a pragmatist, and I really am suspicious of people who have, you know, who speak in vague generalizations on other extreme. I just want to make things better. And I want to keep my eyes on the prize, which is about justice.
Mm. So that brings us to this, Rabbi. Under international law, and many would say, based on what is just and moral, the Palestinians have the right to return to their original homes, their villages, their towns. How does Zionism or the Zionistic thought deal with the Palestinian right of return?
So, you know, again, I hesitate to speak for Zionism or for Zionists on behalf of all Zionists of all time. You know, I won't do that.
Well, then how does your brand of Zionism deal with that?
I can tell you how I deal with that, okay? Categorically, the right of return has been something I think that's been used as a political maxim or a phrase that people struggle with grasping. In my view, the right of return is a principle. It's a fundamental principle that has to be involved in any kind of negotiations between Israel and a future Palestinian state. So it's a principle. Of course, it's a principle that has to be applicable. After all, if people were forced to leave were put upon, turned into refugees, we're going to have to bring ourselves around. I say Jews are going to have to bring themselves around to grappling with that scenario that's unfolded over decades. Now, as a principle, you put it on the table and you negotiate it. I think that anybody knows that you can't then bring everybody back into a state that is fully operative, highly developed, bustling, booming. It can't happen. And so that has to be negotiated.
Why not?
Oh, is number one, I think that it's very clear that Palestinians understandably would want to go back to their villages, you know, in the middle of cities. They'd want to go back to property that's been turned over many times. They'd want to go back to places that no longer exist. They'd want to go back to cities that are now incorporated within other cities, you know, new homes are there. So it's something that needs to be negotiated and something to be worked out, but that's what politicians do. But it's what negotiators do in order to mediate a very, you know, fractious conflict.
Mm-hmm. You know, the right of return of refugees is an individual right and not a right for politicians to negotiate.
It is absolutely a fundamental human right, without question. And guess what? Who else is going to work this out? Like it or not, we know that this is going to enter the political arena. But you're right. As people, we'll put our human rights caps on, we'll say, absolutely, all refugees need to be spoken for. They need to be listened to. And they, not only they have rights, they have dignity. They have stories to tell. And we need to listen to them. We need to honor them. And then how we figure out where to go from there is an entirely other story, and we have to keep our eyes on that fundamental issue.
So we've only got about 5 minutes left here, and I hesitate to take it back into the realm of ideas. But for me, these ideas, how Israel is conceived within the Jewish community here, especially because of the role of the United States. But also within Israel itself, is so fundamental to how people approach the discussion of, say, a particular issue like the right of return. And I'm thinking especially about some comments by Jeff Halper of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. And he talks about how, for him, Zionism it simply is no longer relevant, that Israel has become a state. It is a state. It has all the institutions of a state. It's grown and evolved in ways that could not have been anticipated by its founders. And he feels that it's important that people begin to let go of the initial conceptions of what that state was to look like in terms of being a Jewish state. And I wonder if you could see a Zionism that could accommodate that kind of vision. In other words, the vision that I think a lot of people who support a one-state solution, a democratic, secular state of all its citizens.
So that's a leap. I mean, no. One-state solution to me is a utopian leap. I, as a Jew, can no more entertain the idea of giving up on a productive and a just society that flies the flag, the Jewish flag, or where you sing that anthem. I'm not interested in giving up on that. And I want somehow or other to work it out that Palestinians have their rights and their state and justice and are remunerated for what's happened to them in the past. At the same time, that I know that we need a period of separation. My God, I don't think that we're going to live, even in terms of a pragmatic analysis, I don't think we're going to live together really closely and come back from this divorce into some kind of hug overnight. I just think that's just a dead in the water idea. On the other hand, can we let go? Can Zionists let go of some of the founding ideas in order to grapple with what we have today? Look, people evolve. Communities evolve. Civilizations evolve. Israel has definitely evolved into something other than what it was originally. And people of my age have a lot of grief over that. I mean, we as you grow old, you grieve a lot about what was and is no longer. And yet we all have to find a language in which to speak about what can be in the future. And I really believe that we can keep working on this project. And I actually think that if that we need to evolve into a phase of justice. It's critical in order for Israel to exist in a meaningful way for the Jewish people everywhere. This cannot devolve into simply a militarized state for ad nauseum, and that's what we got right now. And I think people realize it. On the other hand, you know, you've got a highly, highly productive society there, and you've got a society scared out of its mind because it views, rightly, I believe, the region around it as being not only hostile to it, but, you know, being fundamentally characterized by forces that are autocratic or extraordinarily zealous and pose existential threats to the state. So how do you get from square A to square B? That's going to be a difficult thing. But I think we have to keep talking about Zionism in terms of justice and peace and democracy and refining that vision and coming to terms with our neighbors.
Rabbi Joey, what happens to Zionism if the demographers are correct, which is that the 20% non-Jewish population of Israel is growing at a much faster rate and may, in the next 100, 200 years or more, be the majority? What then of the Jewish state?
And you have 30 seconds to answer that.
I'm much more worried right now, honestly, about the portion of the population that's included within the occupation.
I get that, but within the
Even within
Democrat,
the Green Line,
yes.
I'll tell you what, we have our own elements that are reproducing, and I worry about that as well because I worry that we'll end up, you know, swirling into, you know, a zone of, like, who can reproduce the fastest in the most fundamentalist way, and we'll, you know, put this whole dream to bed, and that's not a good idea. So I'd rather deal with, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow, tomorrow meaning the next day after today, than what's going to happen 100 years from now. We've got a lot of work to do for tomorrow.
So you've been listening to One Land, Many Voices. We've come to the end of our discussion with Rabbi Joey Wolf. Rabbi Joey, thanks so much for joining us this morning.
It's been a real pleasure.
And we are going to get another chance to continue this discussion with Rabbi Joey, and we'll involve our listeners the next time around.
We look forward to it. Thank you so much, Rabbi Joey Wolf.
Yes, thank you. And thank you for tuning in to One Land, Many Voices. You can tune in every fourth Friday at 9 a.m. here on Community Radio, KBOO, your community radio station. If you haven't become a member, if you didn't become a member during the last membership drive of just a few weeks ago, please give us a call or go to our website, kbu.fm, and become a member. Renew your membership, up your membership. And, of course, tune in next month for One Land, Many Voices.